The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
As our military campaign intensifies on the ground and in the air, the Defense Department is also developing more strategic options in the cyber domain.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And unless you were listening carefully this week, you probably missed the Pentagon's seeming declaration of war against ISIS on the so-called cyber front. The head of Cyber Command, Michael Rogers, made the case to Congress that his unit should be elevated to be a fully independent command. Meanwhile, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter has let it be known in a series of interviews that Cyber Command has been given, quote, its first wartime assignment, that is in Iraq and Syria, fighting ISIS. Now, excuse my skepticism, and boy, did I get into a friendly shouting match at our editorial meetings yesterday over all this, but they're not saying that they are just now going after encrypted networks in Syria. And how do you cyber attack people living in an already bombed out city like Raqqa? And how does shutting down cell phone service or Netflix make people living under the thumb of terrorists that much more miserable that they're going to rise up against them? We've been tracking ISIS leaders and killing them with drones for years. What's new here? We turn now to Shane Harris, a senior correspondent at The Daily Beast and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex.
We saw them do this once before. So back in 2007 and 2008, the military ran a series of what I would call cyber operations against ISIS's predecessor in Iraq, which is al-Qaeda in Iraq. And what it did was it used the Iraqi telecommunications system, which the U.S. had largely helped to construct, to hack into the email systems, the cellular phones, and the communications networks of the insurgency on the ground. And they did two things when they did that. One was to monitor individuals through their communications and sort of the digital footprints that you leave when you use your cell phone or when you send an email or when you're online, to then locate those people and then go in and capture or finish them off. And the second thing that it tried to do was to disrupt their communications. So what do we mean by that? Denying them communications, shutting down parts of a cellular network, posing as someone that they knew in order to trick them into going to a certain place, deceiving them by appearing to communicate with them in a way that they were familiar with when actually they didn't know it was an American intelligence operative on the other side. What the secretary and officials are talking about now with doing against ISIS is similar to that, but I think is going to probably be a little bit more limited in some ways because we don't have ground troops. But basically disrupting their communications and getting inside that network and trying to spy on them, really, and understand who they are and what they're doing based on their digital patterns.
Now, I'm as impressed by the term cyber war and cyber attack as the next person. But it seems to me that that's basic intelligence, disrupting their communications capability, trying to infiltrate their communications network. And in the Snowden era, where the presumption is that the NSA can spy on me, I would certainly hope that there's nothing new about hacking into cell phone communications of ISIS and al-Qaeda in the Middle East. I mean, this isn't exactly a giant revelation.
No, I don't think it is. It's really not new, and the intelligence community has already been monitoring ISIS fighters via communications. One thing we know is that ISIS is very well aware of that and has taken steps to either encrypt communications or turn off features of certain apps like in Twitter that show your location where you're sending from. So this, a lot of this is basic intelligence gathering, where from the military's perspective, I think it becomes cyber warfare is when you marry that up with what the military likes to call kinetic action. So we're spying on them and doing these things in cyberspace at the same time that we are hitting them from the air or that we're potentially launching ground offensive against them as well. So cyber becomes a piece of this, and it's in that context It's not just about gathering information. It's about gathering information to a particular end, which is capturing or killing them or taking back territory. But it really is about intelligence gathering. And that's why when you hear terms like cyber warfare get thrown around, you know, it kind of leads one to think, well, does that mean we're going to be blowing up, you know, oil refineries via cyber attacks? Are we going to be doing damage to physical infrastructure in these places? And that's possible. I don't think it's very likely. What Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, has said is that we're going after their communication and control networks. Now, that may involve taking down a physical network or blocking access to a certain path of communications. But there, too, that sort of looks a lot more like the surveillance and the intelligence gathering and even maybe something more akin to sabotage than it does to warfare. So the vocabulary around this sometimes can get a little bit muddied, I think.
Well, the good news is they've been doing this for a while, because if they were saying that they just started doing this on cell phones, then I think I really would, you know, hop on a plane for someone somewhere far, far away. But the fact that this has been going on for a while is great news. The confusion then comes, I don't get the impression that ISIS is necessarily vulnerable to, you know, delayed cell phone messages, errors on their computers, and they don't seem to operate from a kind of nerve center that would be prone to the sort of attack that would have catastrophic implications. It would just be picking off this guy here or picking off this guy there.
Well, it could be. It could be picking off many guys, too. What we saw happen in Iraq in 2007 where there, too, there wasn't so much of a centralized communication system the way we would think of a country or another military having one, is that we could learn a lot about who was in charge of the network and how that they were moving people, how they were moving money. Now, we actually know a fair amount about that with ISIS as well, I think in no small part because we monitor their communications. So when Secretary Carter came out and said, you know, I am sort of unleashing this cyber war, I mean, I was certainly sitting there sort of scratching my head thinking, well, this isn't that much different than what we've been doing in the past. And I don't think that we should presume that this is going to open up some new phase that is going to dramatically turn the tide of the war. I mean, and a big reason for that, too, is that we don't have a ground force there. In 2007 and 2008 in Iraq, we had troops on the ground who, when we found these people via their communications, we went in and got them. There is not a competent ground force for retaking, for instance, the city of Mosul in Iraq from ISIS,
right,
which is sort of the big prize.
You know, what constitutes a cyber attack against an organization like ISIS? This sounds suspiciously like we can do everything with air power. Now we can do everything with digital power. It doesn't involve any American casualties, so there's no political downside to it. But, I mean, it seems like the threat to cyber war comes more from China and Russia than it does from folks in Raqqa and the Syrian desert.
Oh, I think that's right in terms of, you know, the threat against, you know, the United States and our interests. Clearly, the bigger ones are the Chinese, the Russians, Iran, which recently the United States just indicted 7 Iranians for hacks, big denial of service attacks against U.S. banks. I mean, there's no doubt that ISIS has expressed interest in trying to, you know, acquire the capabilities to launch cyber attacks that are very effective in propaganda and using cyberspace in that way. But I don't think that that we should be, you know, most worried about cyber attacks coming from the Islamic State.
All right, then Shane Harris, de-encrypt this statement before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 5th of Admiral Michael Rogers, who's head of Cyber Command and NSA, and has expressed interest in having, you know, CyberCom become a full unified command within the Pentagon. Here's what he says.
Today, we have 27 teams that are fully operational and 68 that have attained initial operational capability. And it's important to note that even teams that are not fully operational are contributing to our cyberspace efforts, with nearly 100 teams conducting cyberspace operations today. For example, the command continues to support U.S. Central Command's ongoing efforts to degrade, dismantle, and ultimately defeat ISIL.
Now, is that, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, but is he trying to sell his budget to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or is he telling America that we've got him on the run via computer?
No, I mean, it's more the former. I mean, he is, you know, Admiral Rogers is the second head of Cyber Command. It's a new organization, and has to give some sense that it is doing real work and coming together. Now, that's not to say it's not doing real work, but it is still a fairly, in its kind of early toddler stages, you might say. When he talks about teams and you throw around numbers of teams, you know, 67 here, this many, that many, it starts to add up and look like 100. Those teams could be potentially very small. They could be teams dedicated to a certain kind of hacking or a certain geographic area. The general point, though, is that what Cyber Command has to become is the place where all of the military's cyber efforts, both defensive and offensive, are brought under one umbrella so that you don't have the Army doing its set of a dozen things and the Navy doing its 10 things that it does and the Air Force doing whatever it does. And that is happening, and that's going to happen. This is, you know, an initiative, Cyber Command, that's been underway for several years now. It is still maturing. And I think one of the reasons why the military is talking now about giving Cyber Command this mission against ISIS is because, you know, it's a target. I mean, it says, here is something concrete that they are doing. Here is how their mission is actually evolving into something real, going from an idea to something tangible. They're going after this particular enemy.
Shane Harris, senior correspondent at the Daily Beast and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Shane, thanks so much.
You bet, John. Thank you.
Later this hour,
the whole point of freedom is that we continue to be free to decide how we're going to live our freedom and what we're going to consider that freedom consists of. There's never going to be a kind of a law about how you can and can't use your freedom.
That's Sarah Bakewell, author of At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails. It's a guide to the people and ideas behind the existentialist philosophy movement of the 20th century. And it really is kind of a time machine book that imagines what it would be like to have dinner with Simone de Beauvoir and any of the existentialists. Who would you invite if you had a party like that? I mean, during tough times in your life, economic or otherwise, what book or writer do you turn to for advice and inspiration?
This is Janice calling from Columbia, South Carolina. And I just wanted to say it's the Bible, of course. It's the manual for life.
Philosophers are always just really arguing about the Bible, aren't they? Albany, New York, when I struggle with tough issues, I turn to the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. It helps me reach a quiet and contemplative place from which to consider the tough questions, most of which do not have definitive answers. Milt from Minnesota also seeks and gets inspiration from the ancient Chinese.
This is Milt Lee from Cass Lake, Minnesota. The I Ching by Lao Tzu is unfailing in the advice that it gives to you. I don't know how it does it, but it always works.
My name is Rosemary. I am from Ashland, Oregon. Rumi's Little Book of Life is what I turn to. It keeps me grounded. At 60, I've had my share of life's grief.
For Seattle, Washington, it's Eckhart Tolle's teachings, applicable in nearly every situation. They guide me to make a wise approach to even the most difficult decision or challenge.
My name is Cindy. I'm calling from Central Florida. When I'm faced with life's toughest questions, writer, thinker, or book, do I turn to for advice? Well, I read as many as I can, and then I make up my own mind.
Keep them coming. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway for a complete list of all the ways you can take part in The Takeaway's various conversations. Connect with The Takeaway. You just hit that button on our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
As reporter Shane Harris suggested a few moments ago, it's not as though ISIS operates out of some situation room full of servers that if they went down, it would shut the organization down. At least vulnerability to cyber attack is not the impression of journalist and writer Jürgen Todenhofer.
I lived with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes we slept on the same floor. There was just a Kalashnikov between us.
For 10 days in December of 2014, Totenhofer was embedded with ISIS, and the impression he got was of a band of well-armed criminals who love money, women, and talking big about their plans to take on the world. After months of Skype negotiations and a public guarantee from ISIS that he would return home alive, he went undercover.
The reason why I believed in this guarantee was ISIS wants to be seen as a state. They gave the guarantee as a state. It would be a defeat for them if everybody would say they think that they are a state and they give a public promise and they don't stick to this promise. And therefore, I thought I would come back alive.
What is it like to live under ISIS? And how could you be sure that what they were showing you was any kind of a valid indication of what actually goes on day to day?
They didn't say what I should see. I had a list with 15 points or 20 points. And out of this list, they gave me the opportunity to see, let's say, 70% of the things I asked to see. I said, I want to go to police station. I want to see a jail. I want to walk in the streets, in the souks. I want to speak with people in the street, and I want to speak without the ISIS fighters. And I wanted to see, for example, also a hostage, and I saw a hostage. And so I made the program. They didn't make the program.
Mosul has lots of English and German in it. Were there people who spoke to you saying that they are in fear of criticizing the government or in fear of making known their religious proclivities, whether they're Shiite or Sunni, that sort of thing?
The Shias had been already eliminated, killed, and there were no more Shias, there were no more Christians. The Christians had left, they had the opportunity to stay, but they didn't want to live under the dictatorship of terrorists. So there were only Sunnis, and I had the opportunity to speak in the streets, and sometimes somebody gave me a sign. So the ISIS fighter said, you know, the economy is working and running, and with his hand, the guy who was beside me gave me a sign that he didn't share this opinion. So people are not crazy. They would not say with a loud voice ISIS is terrorism because they would be killed. So they tolerated ISIS. But these things are changing now slowly. Now they are very angry. There is an opportunity now to make something together with the Sunnis of Mosul, Ramadi, etc. There could even be a revolution against ISIS.
We're talking with Jürgen Totenhofer, who was embedded with ISIS in December of 2014. This is The Takeaway. During the time that you were, I presume, finishing up your galleys, the New York Times ran this very detailed piece about the extent to which ISIS supports a kind of infrastructure for sex slavery so that fighters can have access to women sexually. Did you see any evidence of organized sex slavery as has been described in the New York Times and other publications?
No, and I only want to say the things I have seen. They admit that they have introduced slavery. And slavery of girls means that these girls, if somebody owns a slave, he can do whatever he wants with this slave. That's what they think. And I have asked, I had long discussions about slavery because it's a shame that a terrorist organization thinks that they are modern if they introduce slavery. But they told me, you know, we have slavery officially, you have it secretly. But nevertheless, I think it's horrible what they do with, especially with the Yazidi girls. It's just horrible.
Would you describe these folks as actually religious?
I would say that they are, as far as Islam and Quran is concerned, they are illiterates. They have no idea. I discussed with them the Quran. I read the Quran three times. I'm a Christian. And they know certain parts of the Qurans which are dealing with the war between Mecca and Medina. And I confronted them with other parts talking about justice, talking about mercy, and they just didn't know anything about. But nevertheless, I would say they think that they are believers. But I'm completely sure that the leadership of the so-called Islamic State doesn't believe in Islam. They are power guys, very, very tough power guys, but not really Muslims.
You know, there's a lot of talk about what's going to be the end game in Syria. But as you spoke with leadership in ISIS and the individuals that you got close to, should they be at a peace table to resolve what is going on in Iraq and Syria under any circumstances?
No.
No.
No, I'm a friend of negotiations, but not with these terrorists. They think that they will be a part of negotiations. They told me, and it was told to them by their leadership, that one day there would be negotiations, but I told them nobody will talk to you. And we have to defeat them. We have to eliminate them. But I think that our strategy to bombard cities is not the right strategy. There are other ways. We have to stop the delivery of weapons from Saudi Arabia and Qatar to the extremist rebels in Syria. I saw ISIS with German weapons we gave to the Kurdish Peshmergas. At the end, the machine guns were in the hands of ISIS. Then we should close the border between Turkey and the so-called Islamic State. It was too easy to cross this border. I had to run, and it was difficult to run, but it, nevertheless, I'm 75. It was too easy to cross this border. And the third point, which I think is the most important point, ISIS, for example, in Iraq, can only live because it's supported by a discriminated part of the country. So if we would have a national reconciliation in Iraq, then ISIS would be like a fish without water. And the same is true for Syria. If we succeed, for example, in Geneva in a national reconciliation, then ISIS is isolated. ISIS is defeated.
Well, it's great to have your insights, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jürgen Todenhofer is author of My Journey into the Heart of Terror, 10 Days in the Islamic State. It's out April 12th. L'existence, je suppose, souvent n'est qu'une chanson. In the wee hours of the morning, in the coffee-fueled bistros of the night, we find a spot to sit down and, oh my, these folks are having a very serious conversation.
Immorality is subjective.
Yes, but subjectivity is objective.
To avoid suffering, one must not love.
Human beings are divided into mind and body.
But then one suffers from not loving.
Perception is irrational and implies imminence.
Therefore, to love is to suffer, not to love is to suffer.
After all, you know, there are worse things in life than death.
Sounds like a convention of existentialists.
See surface and think that in some sense it's depth, and it isn't.
But of course, it's just a dream of a late-night argument between Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, or Michel Foucault. We assembled it from bits of Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, and Camille Paglia. In the silly season of the 2016 campaign, articulate, actual, serious, smart folks just might be welcome. And that we all might stumble on such real conversations is the dream of author Sarah Bakewell's new book, At the Existentialist Café, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails. The book is a clever and surprisingly entertaining romp through the existentialist movement of the early part of the 20th century, in which Bakewell deftly argues that we really need to be talking just as seriously about issues like the meaning of freedom, existence, and gender in the 21st century.
I visualize it as, you know, there's very familiar figures there. There's Jean-Paul Sartre,
of course,
with his pipe,
yep,
and his sort of, you know, somewhat dumpy shape. And then next to him, there's Simone de Beauvoir.
Of course.
Rather more elegant, also smoking her head off. Albert Camus, another sort of well-known figure with his collar turned up and looking quite Humphrey Bogart-ish and glamorous. Then there's the sort of lesser-known figures and people coming and going. Some people play a role in the story for a little while. So these are kind of encounters that could lead to books. They could lead to interesting conversations. They could lead to fights because their conversation would be of politics, literature, philosophy, and often they'd get so passionately involved in it all that they'd end up falling out.
You take us to a place in time and then try to catapult us into now and to how that outlook might help us. What writers can you imagine that gang hanging out with today, and maybe not even writers, maybe just sort of public figures?
Well, I think that one of the things particularly about Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Camus was, you know, they all saw themselves as being passionately involved in the debates of the day. So I think they would certainly be airing their views on everything from politics to the sort of cultural debates that we have today.
One of the things that's kind of amazing to me is that the existentialists were seen as a fairly brooding bunch, but there's a lot of levity to the way in which they approach philosophy and ideas compared to now. You know, the existentialists seem much more relevant.
But they certainly saw themselves as being relevant, and they also, especially talking about that period in Paris at the end of the Second World War, after the liberation of Paris and when everything seemed to start afresh and everybody was kind of still just getting over the war. But on the other hand, there was this great sense of possibility because all of the old ways or many of the old ways of doing things had been thrown into question. So, you know, getting your values from the state or from the church or from the family, suddenly there was this new sense that you could actually maybe change the human condition and do things in a completely new way. And that's what led to the sort of the image that we have of the existentialists as sort of dancing all night and hanging out in these jazz bars and sort of rebelling and making up their own rules as they went along, sort of rejecting the old bourgeois model as they saw it. It's interesting that Richard Wright, he explicitly wanted to write an existentialist novel about the African-American experience, and that's what The Outsider became. When he first encountered existentialism, he wrote to Gertrude Stein, who was a friend, saying, I can't understand why everybody seems to think existentialism is such a gloomy philosophy. For me, it means freedom and, you know, liberation and optimism, really.
Did the permission that existentialism gave to contemplate in a purely abstract way what being is all about allow Simone de Beauvoir to invent a Western feminism?
Well, she came out of philosophical studies which had included phenomenology, which was this sort of German methodology that you can start philosophy essentially by describing experience, so describing what things are actually like as you encounter them, rather than having to piece it all together from abstract theories. There's this sort of story about the apricot cocktail that was their first encounter with this, which is where a friend of theirs said to them, they were sitting around drinking apricot cocktails one day, and he said, you see, if you're a phenomenologist, you can talk about this cocktail and make philosophy out of it, which became the sort of the great spark that sent them off. It's a way of cutting through some of the philosophical problems about how we can be certain of anything. So you still can't be sure that I'm really here,
right?
But you can act as though you were sure that I was really here,
because I'm doing that's, a good
that
job
makes
that.
A good yes, starting I am. Point for a conversation.
Well, I think young people are attracted to this experimental way of thinking, this breaking of the rules, the different narratives of sexuality. How would you say existentialism applies to the, it seems like there's no conceivable rules in sexuality and gender roles today?
I mean, I think that it doesn't totally look that straightforward. I mean, some fields of life, yes, the enormous battles have been won as far as sexual freedom is concerned. And in other departments, the whole question of freedom is looming up in a much more problematic way again, I think. I mean, there's all sorts of debates about freedom as a sort of civic concept, whether freedom includes the freedom to act in a way that offends others or to speak in the way that offends others. I think there's a lot to talk about. And really, freedom was the central existentialist theme, at least it certainly was for Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And we're no closer to finding any kind of solution, not that there would ever be one. I mean, the whole point of freedom is that we continue to be free to decide how we're going to live our freedom and what we're going to consider that freedom consists of. There's never going to be a kind of a law about how you can and can't use your freedom.
So let's say we're in a cafe in Paris today and we're encountering these characters. First of all, would they have iPhones?
Yeah, that's one of the first things that comes to mind with me when I picture this existentialist cafe is the awful thought that today, instead of conversing, wildly arguing or flirting or whatever they were doing at the time, that they'd all be sitting around staring at their phones. It's a very sad thought. Although, in another way, you could say, well, maybe they're all having very engaging conversations via text messages and Twitter with other people. You know, I mean, they're still conversing, just not with each other.
Sarah Bakewell is the author of At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
The military has accomplished miracles in its ability to keep people alive on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. The survival rate in these wars exceeds anything in the history of warfare. But the delivery of mental health care services to the people who survive, even the people seemingly unscathed physically, has been, by the military's own admission, woefully inadequate and well short of anything miraculous. Suicide rates for veterans, incidents of PTSD and substance abuse are well above expected levels. A story out of member station KUOW Seattle now indicates that lack of proper mental health care screening keeps hidden other disorders that could be expected in high-stress command environments. The Armed Forces Health Surveillance Center says over 3,500 service members were diagnosed with some kind of eating disorder, typically anorexia or bulimia, over a 10-year period ending in 2013. At the end of 2015, the Army put out a major Health of the Force report that talked about soldiers not being physically fit to deploy, but there was no mention of eating disorders. Patricia Murphy, military and veterans reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle, spoke with Marine Lieutenant Teresa Larson about how she was left on her own to struggle with bulimia. Murphy says there's almost no way to know who is silently battling life-threatening eating disorders at the very same moment they may be facing enemies on the battlefield.
A lot of these disordered eating behaviors, like fasting or over-exercising or using laxatives, can really exist at a very low level in a soldier or a service member's life for quite some time before it may become out of control.
Yet I was struck by how in Teresa Larson's story, this eating disorder is really entwined into her sense of achievement within the military. Listen.
I didn't want to show weakness. So, and to me, weakness was admitting I needed help, not knowing something, not being as fast as everyone. So I made sure I was in great shape, that I stuck up for my Marines, took care of them, kind of forgot about myself.
So the pressure rises as service goes on. But as the moment of deployment approached, things began to unravel a little bit. Explain how she told you about that.
Teresa Larson had always engaged in restrictive eating behaviors. It was part of who she was. When she started to vomit her food, when she started to exhibit bulimic behaviors, she immediately felt a sense of relief. This was a way for her to control things in her life when a lot of things she felt were out of her control.
You immediately feel relief, like, okay, thank God that's done. But then you're like, crap, what did I just do? And then the depression sits in. So the depression just kind of sinks you deeper and deeper into the hole. But you keep doing it because it's like it becomes very addictive. It's an addictive behavior. So it's like you almost get high off of the throwing up.
In that very act of sort of that intensity of the addictive behavior, she's also able to keep everyone thinking that she's performing just fine.
I convinced everyone around me, like, I'd be fine. When I deploy, obviously, it's going to go away because I'm going to be super busy and I'm going to be working all the time and I have other people to take care of, which I'm really good at. So I deployed and that's kind of where things started to unravel little by little.
Absolutely, things started to unravel for her because before women were recognized in combat, Teresa Larson was doing some very difficult work in Iraq. Because she was a lieutenant, she was not living with her troops. And this sense of isolation while she was deployed really started to contribute to these behaviors and this problem within herself in general. She was able to hide a lot more easily, right? You know, she was not necessarily always around her troops or her Marines. And one of the things that's so difficult about having an eating disorder is you have to make peace with food, with something you need to live. And that's extremely difficult to do, not only in a war zone, but without any real mental health assistance with some very specialized treatment, especially when it gets to this point.
You talked to some medical professionals here, and we're going to hear from one in a moment. I'm curious as to how the actual military lifestyle in an unintentional way enables these kinds of behaviors and maybe sustains them in a way that wouldn't be the case in the civilian world.
Absolutely. You know, the military creates the perfect storm of risk factors for an eating disorder. You have exposure to combat stress, intense pressure to perform, strict weight limits, and beyond that, very little dialogue or outlet to express vulnerability or problems you may be having.
It's really sad when you listen to Dr. Neeru Bakshi, who's a medical director at the Eating Recovery Center in Bellevue, Washington. And that's an outpatient and residential care facility that's part of your story. Just how wrapped up in these behaviors these patients get. Listen.
They will actually use their eating disorders to support what they need for those physical requirements. We'll have vets that come to us saying, well, prior to my needing to meet X and Y and Z for my physical requirements test, what I did was I was in the gym 6 hours a day. And that's actually a form of their eating disorder.
How do you break something like that?
It's very difficult, and especially in cases like this, because it works for them, right? They meet their physical requirements. These behaviors in and of themselves at a low level don't seem very problematic. It's only when they begin to spiral and turn into something bigger than you, it creates its own narrative in your life. And we spoke to an Army psychologist who is interested in eating disorders and runs an eating disorder group at Madigan Army Medical Center here in Washington State. She has 10 people in that group. Some of them have maintained their eating disorders for 20 plus years.
Eating disorders in the military. Patricia Murphy, military and veterans reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle. Patricia, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
And here's something to take with you today. Existentialism does feel a little bit like a generic term for people asking lots of very obtuse, abstract questions that might motivate and get over it. But it turns out that the founders of the movement weren't completely clear on the word. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir only agreed to be called existentialists because it was easier than telling people not to identify them in that way. It's convenient. But check out the existentialist message, won't you? I mean, get out in the world. Make a difference. Have a little adventure in your sex life. That's one of the messages. Keep it real. Basically, try to be more authentic in your life. Go out, pick up a copy of Camus or The Second Sex, buy an overpriced latte, embrace your inner existentialist, whatever that means to you. Just don't start smoking and use sunscreen. That's important. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.